This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 71. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This show is titled The Fugitive and is being released on Monday, March 29, 2010. My interview with Alan Shoemaker was recorded on March 23, 2010. A quick note for those who've requested it, my book, The Holy Mushroom, is now available on Kindle through Amazon.com. And today's podcast is a short one at about 45 minutes. And the following is what the DEA and U.S. Justice Department have to say about our quote-unquote fugitive, today's guest. His name, Shoemaker Alan Thomas. Fugitive number W52438123-5, wanted for the following alleged federal drug violations: possession of a hallucinogen, MDMA. Jurisdiction, Northern District of Georgia, a.k.a. Alan Smith. Race, white. Sex, male. Height, 6 foot. Weight, 170 pounds. Hair brown, eyes green. Year of birth, 1953. Place of birth, Kentucky. Last known address, Iquitos, Peru. Do not attempt to apprehend this individual. And that sounds like one dangerous man. But today we've apprehended Alan for the next 45 minutes, so hold on as Alan takes us on a ride with the serpent vine, the vine of the souls, ayahuasca. Alan Shoemaker was born in the mountains of southeastern Kentucky and graduated from the University of Kentucky with a pre-law major focusing on psychology, criminology, and theater arts. He was the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts grant as artist in residence and placed in Buchanan County, Virginia for 1 year. Here he also taught 35mm photography, black and white darkroom techniques, and acting. Alan moved to Seattle, Washington and worked as a child psychologist for several years while becoming involved in mountaineering and rock climbing, inventing a new powder for keeping your hands dry and not leaving marks on the cliffs. He represented several high-tech mountaineering and backpacking companies in the Pacific Northwest and became a distributor in the United States of a line of rock climbing shoes known as Vertical Footwear, which he also helped design in Italy. He was the co-founder and artistic director of Sanctuary Theater Group in Seattle, a professional theater company. 15 years ago, he had a spiritual calling to come to the Amazon to study shamanism, and listen to that, leaving the USA by land via Mexico and Central America, finally being led to his first teacher, Dr. Valentin Hampius, outside of Quito, Ecuador. The Putumayo River and a 15-meter dugout canoe for 2,500 kilometers brought Alan to Iquitos, where he began his next apprenticeship with various mestizo curanderos. He has lectured on curanderismo all over the United States and Europe and has been published in Shaman's Drum, Journal for Peace and Humanities, Magical Blend, etc., as well as having been a featured presenter in conferences. Alan founded Soga del Ama, Vine of the Soul, 7 years ago and recently finished building their second chapel on the Rio Itaya, just outside Iquitos, Peru. For more information, go to Gracia Ethnobotanicals or www.soga-del-alma.org. Donations this week, my love and thanks goes out to Christopher R.D., Christopher, again, a different Christopher, and Richard. This show is dedicated to all of you, and thank you so much. If you'd like to donate directly to Gnostic Media, please go to the Gnostic Media website at GnosticMedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com, and the donation button is up near the top left of the page. This show is mostly run on donations. We are not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words, and by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the She Who Remembers audio archives off of the website, you help continue our programming, and without your help, we cease to be here. We're still offering 25% off of most items on the Gnostic Media website, so don't forget to check that out. Upcoming shows, Dr. Peter Duesberg, professor of molecular and cell biology at UC Berkeley, considered one of the world's leading virologists and cancer researchers, will be here to continue our discussion on AIDS. And I actually just finished recording that interview with Peter about an hour ago, and it's a good one. So you won't want to miss that, and that's going to be next Monday. Also coming up, Hermann de Vries from Germany to discuss scopolamines, the deadly nightshades, belladonna, mandrake and datura, and also some henbane. Though he doesn't consider himself one, he's probably the world's only scopolamine expert. And also Eric Blair will be on to discuss allopathic medicine, and Hank Alberelli to discuss his book A Terrible Mistake on the Murder of Frank Olson and the CIA's MKUltra Project, as well as the recent blow-up in the media about the Saint-Pont-Esprit incident in France, where the CIA dosed an entire village, ending up killing several people and hospitalizing hundreds. And also, Dr. Norman Finkelstein is lined up to talk about his new book on Gaza. And Acharya S., or D.M. Murdoch, is lined up for another interview. And also, Professor John Hupps from University of Kansas will be back on to discuss the 2012 meme. And also, Dr. Robert Beckstead will be joining us to discuss Joseph Smith's magical mushroom journey and the creation of Mormonism. And also, former school teacher Brett, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, Venois, from the School Sucks podcast, is scheduled to come on. And lastly but not least, the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. And once again, if you'd like more information, visit the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com. You can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. Alan, welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. It's always wonderful and hot and humid and lovely down here in the green jungle of the upper Amazon in Iquitos, Peru.
Did you want to start off by telling the audience a little bit about yourself and what you do, and we'll sort of take it from there as we go?
Sure, yeah. I'm Alan Shoemaker. I was born in Harlan, Kentucky, in Appalachia. divorced my sister when I was 17 and left with the two retarded children and never went back. Now, I came here from Seattle about 17 years ago. I had a calling to come here. I had a some strange event happen that told me to go to the Amazon. And I've had these things since I was a child, so I've learned to pay attention to them. And it told me to go here, to come to the Amazon, and I had no idea why. And anyway, I packed up, and I had, at the time, 22 different sponsors because I was in the mountaineering industry and as a manager of a mountaineering shop called Feather Friends in Seattle. And so I knew how to get gear. So basically, I'm a photographer, too, so I told the manufacturers that I would give them a photograph of their product in use in the jungle. So it was a win-win. So I got the gear that I wanted, and they got photographs for publicity. And came down by land through Central America and got to Quito, Ecuador, and where I found my first teacher, a doctor, Dr. Valentin Hampes, neurosurgeon, psychiatrist from Vienna, Austria, who was working as a shaman and as an MD. So he was an excellent person to start working with because he knew when to give you penicillin and when to give you cat's claw. So he was primarily working with San Pedro. And every time I would look at a map, Iquitos was just like pulling at me like a magnet. So finally I went back up to Colombia to the headwaters of the Puerto Asís, headwaters of the Putumayo River, and looked for a dugout canoe and a 40-horsepower Yamaha motor. Finally got one in about two weeks, and came on down the Amazon and stopped to drink ayahuasca with the various indigenous along the way until I got to Leticia, stayed there for a month and a half. That's in Colombia. And was brought up to Iquitos on a big cruise ship, air-conditioned, because I'd been hired to do some videos for their international trade shows. And rode those boats for a couple of months, doing little documentary films for them. And got to Iquitos, and it was just magic. It was I saw the men drinking beers and getting drunk in the bar and spitting on the floor and doing high fives and hugging each other and singing songs, whereas in Seattle, and the bars over in Ballard, the men, you know, drinking and they get in fistfights. So this is a very passive place. It's really magic. There's seven girls, believe it or not, born to every one boy, and no one can really figure out why that is. And I really don't care, but I love those odds. But the women here are absolutely beautiful, and everyone's really open. There's no.
Seven girls to every male in Iquitos?
Seven to one. It's unreal. They blame it on the aguaje fruit, saying it's got some feminine hormones in it or something. But I did some research on that, and it doesn't. Apparently, that's not true. But I don't know why. I don't know if they're having sex upside down or sideways, or I have no idea. But so that makes even for a Peruvian man, he's a king here, and that makes for very little jealousy too, because if they don't like the way their woman's behaving, they just simply get another one. And for a gringo coming down here, a gringo represents being able to take them to a disco or take them to dinner or buy them a beer or whatever, and because 65% of people are out of work. So for the passengers or tourists coming down here, if you're a single man, you're in a lot of danger. If you're a married man, you better not let your wife know about this place. I'm married, separated now from my wife. We were married 14 years. I've got two children. They live with me. Claire is 11 and Liam is 12. They're in school now. And we have a travel agency, and I run the Shamanism Conference. And I've had various teachers here with ayahuasca over the years. I don't work with teachers anymore, but I certainly do logistics for a whole lot of people that are coming down here looking for a place to go, to diet, to be in ceremony with La Madre Ayahuasca, the mother ayahuasca, and do the tickets for them. Keeps me busy. And got five dogs, three Pekingese and two big ones. The small ones are supposed to keep the big ones awake. So they'll do something if someone ever breaks in. I've never had a problem, though. Never been held up.
You never been held up? Well, that's good. That's a good thing, I suppose, right?
No, they'll never do anything physically to you here. What they will do is they'll trick you if you're stupid enough to allow yourself to be tricked. And that's like at the money exchange places, tricky calculators, hiding your money in your suitcase and thinking you've got $1,200 and you've hidden it away. And they will find it, and they'll take, you know, a couple hundred. And when you come back, you count it, and you think, I must have made a mistake. I thought I had $1,200 here. Because, you see, if they steal it all, then you call the police. So, you know, they'll take advantage of you that way, but you just have to stay on your toes. And as long as I've been here and I'm a Peruvian citizen now, I'm still looked at as a gringo, and for the people that don't know me, and there's somebody every day, they'll try to take you, like a cab driver will drop me off, and it's one soul and a half, and they'll say, well, it's two souls, it's gone up. And I say, no, it hasn't gone up. It's a soul and a half. I live here, I've been here 17 years, please. He said, no, it's two souls. I said, tell you what, instead of arguing anymore, I'll take the key out of the motor car and walk into my house. I said, when you've got my 50 cents to give back to me, I'll hand your key back to you. Just to avoid arguments.
That's pretty funny. Well, you know, and they living, yeah. having been down there myself, I've definitely seen some of that type of stuff going on. But, you know, usually they were pretty good about bartering, and I think we did just as much barter and game playing with them as they did with us.
Yeah, probably so.
All right. Well, you got into a little bit of trouble with the United States federal government. How did that happen?
Well, you know, I was here. You have to make a living, so I looked around to see what people were doing, and I saw that the university, as well as the mayor's office, and several other people in Iquitos, professors, companies in Cusco and Lima were all shipping out medicinal plants, which included the ayahuasca vine and the chacruna leaf that are used to, when you cook them together, to make ayahuasca. And so my wife got a license to export plants, and she began exporting just like everyone else, and slowly built a business. And I helped her, of course, because she's not that fluent in English. And so she was shipping to Europe and States and, you know, everywhere. And then my son came down to visit, my son Jesse from a previous marriage. And he, we turned him on to shamans and ceremony with ayahuasca, and he really liked it. He came for 2 weeks and stayed for 7 months. And, you know, it was, he was lucky to get out alive because the women were chasing him everywhere. But he decided to go back to the States, and he wanted to have an herb retail business of selling Amazon herbs. So I, along with my wife, collected a bunch of plants for him and shipped it up to him, no charge, and very expensive to ship, and all the export permits in place and phytosanitary permits in place and everything perfectly like all shipping stuff. I've always been done. But the DEA decided to seize this one, and they seized it at my ex-wife's house. She's an attorney for the EPA in Atlanta. They didn't make any arrests, and that was that. And my attorney in Sacramento said just to leave it alone because something more interesting should come across their desk soon, and they'll, you know, do something else. Peter Gorman, at the time, also the journalist, called the DEA agent at the Atlanta Task Force and asked him why he just illegally seized legal plants. And he said, yeah, I know they're illegal, but they shouldn't be. And before Shoemaker gets them back, I'm going to make sure it's going to cost him $50,000, and I'm going to store them in such a way that they will be useless when he does get them. So about a year later, my mother's dying of cancer, and so I had to fly out of here immediately, and I flew into Atlanta, and I mean into Miami. And I was arrested. It was a sealed arrest warrant, and then it was later, it was a conspiracy to distribute DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which I have no idea about that. And I would get strange emails down here, too, that would say, is your background chemistry? And my background is English and English literature, theater. Anyway, briefs go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until finally... the judge says I can take off the ankle bracelet and I can go where I want to, and they ask me where I'm going, and I said, well, I'm going down to Peru where my family is, and they said, yeah, just let us know where you are. And as soon as I arrived here, the prosecutor went in front of the judge and said that I came down illegally without a passport, and I had to send up a copy of my passport being stamped out and my tickets and everything. And then she said, okay, well, we want him here in 4 days to explain why he's in Peru, and that was in the middle of July. And there were no seats available. Had there been a seat, it was $3,500. And I couldn't afford to do that. So then I couldn't make that meeting, of course, so then she had me declared a fugitive. So if you look at the DEA wanted list, a fugitive list on their website, Atlanta Division, my photograph's up there with a lot of Cubans and a lot of African Americans and people wanted for murder. And I'm there, and it says wanted for, which is, this is really bizarre, it says wanted for possession of MDMA. Which I have no idea where that's coming from, who put that up there, what that means, I have no idea. So right now, and they got $6,000 cash bond of mine, and the prosecutor went to the judge and tried to get the bond money, and the judge says, nope, obviously your people told him he could go to Peru, you can't have it. So it's stalemate, that money's sitting there, they don't get it, I can't touch it. So this is my, Peru is my prison. So if I had to pick a prison, I couldn't pick a better one in the world.
All right. Now talk about your shaman conference and what you do down there.
Well, over the years of being on the forums, ayahuasca forums.ayahuasca.com, and being on Tribe and being on Spirit Plants, and having so many people make up pseudonyms to use because most people are afraid to use their real name. Initially, I announced on forums.ayahuasca.com that let's have a international Amazonian shamanism conference, and so we can meet face to face. We can get to know who these people are, who we are. And it turned out to be successful. I said that I would take the first 100 people, but after it rose to well over 100, 165, I think, first year, I couldn't say no to these people. I just had to make more room. So, and then the year before last, we had 215. So it's been growing every year, except for last year. That was the smallest, but that was this economic crisis, and that put a crunch on everybody. I think we had 85 people last year. But things are looking better this year. I've had a lot of early bird discount people sign up to get a discount by paying early, and I've got some incredible people lined up, including Roy Haber, the attorney for the Sansodyne in the Oregon case. He's going to come and speak about the current laws involved with ayahuasca, whether that be use on a personal basis or in a group with the church or in groups with an unregistered church, as it were. Yeah, that's worked out really well. And McKenna comes almost every year, Peter Gorman. I've had a lot of scientists, a lot of doctors, a lot of really good coordinators coming in here from Colombia and from the Andes and Ecuador. And I really take my time to handpick these, quote, shamans. We know them better here as coordinators, so that I can guarantee you that when you go out to be in ceremony with one of them, that it will be an excellent ceremony, and these are true healers. And so, from time to time, I discover someone new, someone that hasn't been discovered, unfortunately or unfortunately, as it may be, bring them into the fold, and the public gets to know about them. But for instance, Percy Garcia and Norma Panduro, who passed away from a stroke about 2.5 years ago, they're doing incredibly well now, and they had hardly anything before this began. Norma did have a compound, but she wasn't as well known. And Percy just had like a thatched roof hut out in the jungle. But I love finding people like that. And, some people give me a hard time because they should be left alone, they say. But if they're left alone, they have 4 or 5 children and a family. And they need to be paid for what they do. And so if they can manage making some money and spend the right way and stay as humble and honest as they were before, then that's wonderful. And most of them so far have been able to do that. And besides getting 200 people here, like I say, this Peru is my prison. So if I can't go to you, then I'll bring you to me. it's kind of like a tunnel vision, because the only people I really talk to are people that are involved in shamanism and healing. So it's just a beautiful world as far as I can tell, because these are the only people that I see. And normally, if people have some really bad aspects of their personality, they consider coming here and coming into the shamanistic world as sort of a vacation and a time to be very positive. And that's the only parts of the personality I get to see. So those really irritant parts, they put those on hold until maybe they get home. Or maybe they drink enough ayahuasca and get some light shown into the right crevices, that those parts are more under control.
Well, we tried to make it up there to Iquitos last summer. I think it was around the 11th or something like that. But I was, I think, either in the hospital or just fresh out of the hospital, and making it up there wasn't doable. So we ended up just going up to Cusco and hanging out up there for a couple of days instead.
Yeah, I love Cusco and the Sacred Valley and Machu Picchu. I guide that every year after the conference. Take usually about from 10 to 20 people up there, and unfortunately, right now, they're really struggling. There's no tourism. The valley's still pretty much closed. Everything was flooded out. So if you're thinking about taking the holiday after you leave Iquitos, the next best place to go to is up there, and drop some money up there, because people are really desperate right now.
You were talking about the shamans that you hand select yourself. What do you think about Marlene Dorios's book, A Hallucinogenic Tea Laced in Controversy?
Well, you know, I think she's probably the woman that coined the phrase ayahuasca tourism. And that was a bit of an irritating phrase for someone to come up with because it's just non-existent. To be a tourist, for instance, if you go to Appalachia, where I grew up, for instance, and you want to go see a coal mine, there's many of them that are closed down because the coal's too dirty, but the mines are open and the little cars are running. You can sit, you can put a hard hat on with the light and you can sit in the car and they'll run you through and you can see a coal mine. That's tourism. To be an ayahuasca tourist would mean that there would be bleachers outside of the Maloca, the ceremony of Maloca. People would come in and pay for a ticket and they would sit in the bleachers and they would watch the ceremony. The people coming down here are not by any means tourists. These people are in the event. They are in ceremony. They are participating in the healing session. They are they're purging from both ends. And there's nothing touristy about that at all.
That's very well put, actually. You're familiar with Josh Homan, correct?
What's the name?
Josh Homan. H-O-M-A-N. He goes down to Peru all the time. He's been studying a lot of the shamanism aspects, and he's actually gone around and met a lot of the same shamans that worked with Marlene, and he's had a chance to go through the police and hospital records down there, and he didn't find a whole lot of support for some of the claims that were in her last book.
Yeah, I think she's got her things pretty much skewed, but I think she begins writing her pieces with that attitude. So I don't think she's starting from the right place. You know, I've also discussed this with the police here in town a few years ago, and they told me that, and this is not has anything to do with the tourism or travelers coming down here. It's the locals. So on any given Friday night, which particularly the Tuesdays and Fridays are the nights typically that are used to drink ayahuasca here, but on Friday even more so because you have Saturday the following day, you can get off work probably. That 10% of the population is in ceremony. Now, there's 500,000 people here. That's 50,000 people. Locals. 50,000 people drinking ayahuasca on Friday night.
Wow.
That is incredible. And we also hear a lot of people talking about the vine is disappearing, the shakuna is disappearing, the charifung is disappearing. That is absolutely absurd as well. The vine is so plentiful. If you take a piece and a fresh piece and throw it on the ground, it's gonna root. I mean, I've got to put a fence around my property with barbed wire, where I have my Sogo del Alma, which is a vine of a soul church that's registered here as well. That's another story. But we use this tree called sisal, and you slice it up and stick the post in the ground, and you come back in 3 weeks, and each post is turned into a tree. So besides that, there's several people here and up in Pucallpa and way up the Marañón and the Pucallpa rivers and the Ucayali rivers that have plantations in. And they are looking for people to purchase. They grow it for a living. So there's no worry about running out of vine here. I don't know about Brazil, but I imagine it's the same down there too.
Why do you suppose that this whole fear has been created regarding the ayahuasca tourism? You know, and a lot of statements were made in her book about rapes being a constant threat and a lot of the shamans not being careful about people's diet and things like that. What is your opinion of all of those?
Well, as far as the rapes going, that happens anywhere, everywhere you're going to have a group of females coming in, whether they're tourism for ayahuasca or tourism to see just the wild jungle and staying in an albergue or a compound downriver or upriver. That happens, and it's unfortunate.
Or for that matter, if you have girls going to a sports bar in downtown Orange County on a Friday night.
Exactly. I just had a woman come in from San Francisco. She'd been living here. She went up to work for a couple of months, and she the last night there, she went to a bar to meet her friends. Her friends left. She had a drink on the table. She got up to go dance, came back. She can't remember anything else except she was walking down the street with just her panties on, and a man pulled over, picked her up, and took her back to her hotel, which she could remember, and she had been drugged and raped. That kind of stuff does happen. It's really rare. But with thousands of people coming through here, you know, it's just, you know, it's going to happen. So you have to watch out what you're doing. Be careful. And that's why it's really important that when you go out to be with the coordinator, you don't think that the light's been shown on you and you'll just find it. You need to do your research and do your emailing and check references and see who you're working with, women especially. And especially be careful if you're working in a place like Pucallpa, which has access to Lima, which has 10 million people. So you can commit a crime in Lima, in Pucallpa, and you can take off to Lima and just disappear. But here in Iquitos, the crime rate is very, very, very low, especially physical crimes, because we're an island. And to get out of here, you've got to fly, take the river. So the police cover the airport, and they cover the port. So you can't hide in the jungle very long. So that's why the crime rate's really low here.
Are shamans generally careful, in your opinion, regarding health issues and diet and eating meat and things like that and watching out for people's medications?
Yeah, they've learned about the medications recently. But when I first got here 17 years ago, anyone could come into a ceremony. But at that time period, there were no gringos coming around.
I think 17 years ago, though, there were a lot less people taking Prozac and things like that.
Exactly. Prozac and any kind of a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, even the asthma inhalers are also contraindicated. So if you're on any kind of medication, you need to check with your doctor to make sure you can take an MAO inhibitor with that, and just to get his approval. And sometimes you need to get off for like 2 or 3 weeks, depending on what you've been taking. A lot of the shamans here now are up on that kind of information. They ask the people what kind of medicines they're on. And so it's much better than it used to be. When I got here 17 years ago, I was just dealing with Peruvians coming in with sick babies and sick grandmothers and physical ailments as well as spiritual ailments and soul loss and that kind of stuff. And those questions were never asked. But they are now. Not by all of them, but by most of them. And as far as the diet goes, the typical diet is no salt, no sugar, no oil, no sex, and no hot spices. While you're probably start about 3 or 4 days before you become into a ceremony and finish that maybe a week after you've finished a week or 2 week program, something like that. But you have to understand that the ayahuasca coming into the city here of Iquitos came from when we had the rubber boom over 100 years ago. And the indigenous were out in the jungles, and they were tapping the trees, and they were selling the rubber balls to the rubber barons. And this is a time period in Iquitos when wearing three-piece suits and women were walking down the streets with aerosols, and the men smoking big fat cigars and lighting them with bills, shipping their dirty clothes off to Europe to be washed. It was an incredibly wealthy area. So when the rubber boom was over, the locals who went out to work in the jungle with the indigenous came back into town, and they told their stories. And the most exciting story, of course, to the people here was to hear about these visions that they had had while drinking ayahuasca, whether it be they're seeing their family or the spirits, or spirits telling them how to deal with people that are sick. And they wanted to do that. And of course, these people hadn't been out there for about 15 years doing these ceremonies, knew how to cook, knew the Icaros, knew how to use shakapas. Those are the leaves that you shake on people. And used tobacco. And so they told him, yeah, well, we drank tea twice a week, so why don't you come here on Friday and we'll have a ceremony. So they came over and said, well, but isn't there some sort of a diet? Because they were using medicinal plants at that time period, too, and they all knew, as they do now, that if you're taking a certain plant, you need to watch what you're eating, depending on what plant you're taking. They said, yeah, the diet, yeah. Well, the diet would be, let's see, when we were in the jungle, we didn't have any salt, we didn't have any sugar, we didn't have any oil, and we didn't have sex because we couldn't have sex with the indigenous women because the men would kill them. So that became the diet. And so technically, from a chemical point of view, that makes no sense whatsoever. The diet should be that you shouldn't have anything that's been fermented primarily. But that diet has been disseminated now and passed around from curandero to curandero, to their sons, to their sons' sons, to us now that have done a little more research on the thing. And the diet is, you know, maybe it's real, maybe it's not. It's hard to say. Another take on that is that when you're drinking ayahuasca, you're in ceremony, you want the spirits to come into you, sit right down inside of you, so you can have their healing coming through you. It's not about you. Or so they can come close enough to tell you what you need to know about someone that's ill or what's wrong with yourself. And so it could be that because salt, sugar, and oil are foreign to your system, you have to actually put those in your body, that those things are like a toxin to a spirit. And the more you have those in your system, the less likely they want to come near you. And the less sex you've had, the more energy you have built up in your sexual chakra. And because when you go back to the spirit world, which we all came from and we will return to, you won't be eating and certainly you won't be having sex, but you'll remember that sensation. So people that have not had sex, having that energy, it works like a magnet towards bringing people, to bring the spirits closer to them. So, and of course, the other thing is that, you know, maybe you should just give up anything. Say, okay, I'm not going to do this, because you're opening yourself up to La Madre Ayahuasca, the Mother Ayahuasca, showing her that you can give this up because you want to receive something more. So, any way you look at it, probably the best thing to do is to follow this traditional diet, no salt, no sugar, no oil, and no sex. That's probably the best thing to do.
So you think that the abstinence from sex is one of the most important parts of the diet?
Well, my most incredible experience was when I hadn't had sex for 18 months, and that was on the Putumayo River. And that was the most incredible vision I've ever had. And because all the coordinators believe that not having sex is the best way to go, I have to agree that, you should not have sex probably about a week before you get here and continue that for like a week after you've finished.
That's very interesting. I, and I've always heard about the idea to abstain from sex during these ceremonies, but I've never heard anybody place that much emphasis on that single facet.
Yeah. Well, if you look at, like I say, you know, we're using this physical body for a short period of time. We're here basically on a holiday to enjoy ourselves, to use our five or six senses, to eat, to have sex, certainly. And then you're back where you belong. You're back in the spirit world. So, you know, when you're in the spirit world, I don't envision spirits having sex. I can't see them intertwined and grunting and groaning and sweating. So they probably miss that sensation. So if you're not having sex, you want to pull the spirits into you, then it's like a magnet. So, you know, I think that's the way to go.
Talk about the use of tobacco.
When I first started working with Valentin, we would get to his house at 8 o'clock in the morning, and he was the kind of guy, he didn't want us eating any food on the morning of ceremony. So we'd get to his house at, say, Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, taking the bus way out to the countryside, and he would give us only Wayusa tea. Wayusa is like a diuretic. It also has loads of caffeine in it, I believe. And so we'd just sit around and talk and listen to really beautiful music. He has an altar there with full of flowers and every deity you could imagine represented there, and incense going, and around 7 p.m. he stands up and begins his prayers in the north, south, east, and west, and up and down, and around 11 o'clock he hands me a glass of tobacco juice, Mapacho tobacco juice, which is the natural tobacco grown here, and I just say, okay, Valentin, hand me the glass, open the door, and get out of my way, because you're going to empty the contents of your stomach. So you go out into the yard and you throw up all the wayusa that you have in your stomach and maybe some old fermented beef that's still in there, and go back in and wait about a half an hour, then you get a glass of San Pedro. Then that lasts for about 12 hours, but about daybreak, go outside, lay down, rinse your nose off, and you get a syringe full of tobacco juice in each nose, and it drops into your sinus cavities. And you tip your head back, and it drops into the sinus cavity where your third eye is. And then you drink down all that phlegm with tobacco juice into your stomach, and then drink about a 16-ounce cup of warm wayusa tea, and that provokes you to vomit up the phlegm and all the tobacco that you just imbibed. You do that 3 or 4 times, and when you're finished, you've never heard your voice before because it's like crystal clear. And when you finish with that, you take all your clothes off, you get stinging nettles, your sprayed with like a alcohol flower solution, and then you get stung with these lashed with stinging, tiny stinging nettles all over your body, and that again is releasing toxins from your system. And then you go over to the big vat, like 50 gallons that have been steeping all night of all these herbs, aromatic herbs that people have brought in, and you take a bowl full of that and rinse yourself 3 or 4 times, wash yourself with that, and don't use anything synthetic on your body for 24 hours, like toothpaste or deodorant or anything like that. But tobacco is certainly an integral part of that. And then when I got down here to the jungle and started working with my first ayahuasquero, who was a curandero shaman specialist with ayahuasca, I remember the first thing he told me was that, he said, "Alan, when you need to go outside to the bathroom, light a cigarette." And I said, "Yeah, okay." And he kept saying that, so finally I asked him why. He says, "Just by virtue of you having a cigarette and the smoke coming out from your hand, and you smoking it, gives you like a veil of protection from any kind of negative energies that may be out there that you might encounter. So it's used also that way." So yeah, it's one of the maestro, one of the master plants here. And I've been smoking for 32 years. I was a little bit irritated when I got here to see my first teacher in ceremony smoking finos, they call them, that's filtered cigarettes, instead of smoking the rolled up mapache, which would be classic what I wanted to see him smoke. And I finally asked him about it, and he says, "Well, do you smoke mapache?" I said, "No, it's too strong. I can't possibly." He said, "Well," he said, "for him too, he's seeing like 30, 35 people, 40 people a night in ceremony, and then all day coming in for their arcanas, their protection things, and he can't handle them either, too strong." But it's tobacco, and it works. I used American Spirit for a long time. That worked really fine. But still, to this day,
Fortunately, those are about as expensive as can be to get down in Peru as well.
Oh, yeah, I have to have people carry it in for me, yeah. Cigarettes down here cost me, about $1.
$1.50, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. So when are you coming down here again?
That's a good question. It's typically just a financial thing, but I would love to get down there, or get back down there, I should say, and get into the jungle. My entire last trip was spent in the furthest north I went was pretty much Cusco and then Lima, but most of my time was spent down in the south. I spent a lot of time in Ilo, in Arequipa, and one of the beach towns out that way as well.
Yeah, I've been up to Mangaroa too. That's a beautiful place. White sand beaches, and it's the best surfing in Peru, and they have lobster on the special of the day for lunch, like 15 soles, lobster tail, and yeah.
And for those that don't know, that's about $5. Let me ask you about dark shamanism.
You hear tell about that all the time, all these brujos running around, and there's only one brujo that I really can substantiate, and that's my big black dog here, and his name is Brujo, and that's the reason I named him that, because I can point out he's the only one that's got any kind of power over anybody. He's a big dog, and he's scary. But this brujo and shooting magic darts and doing evil things to people, if you open yourself up to that kind of idea, that kind of thought patterns, then you're going to find yourself in that kind of a world. So it's like, for me, it's brujos is like dusting some sand off the shoulder of my shirt. It's just, if you go into your closet, you close the door, it's pitch black and there's no air light coming in from anywhere. And if you take the tiniest little match and strike it, that little bit of light gets rid of all that darkness.
What would you say to two guys like Professor Neil Whitehead and Dr. Steve Baer, because their research shows that that's actually something it seems to have been largely suppressed in our own culture and in studying South American cultures. Almost from the angle that we're doing their cultures a disservice by not talking about it or ignoring that it is there.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. There are, for instance, there's 3 or 4 women that I've been to, I've taken people to also, that when they've had something stolen, they want to know who did it, we go see this woman. She takes a string with a needle on the end and holds it down inside of a glass, and it sort of revolves around, and you start saying names of possible people that would have stolen whatever you're missing, and that needle will ding on the side at some point when you say a particular name, and they'll say that's the person that stole it. And I've seen that turn out to be true. Now, that is a form of what you're talking about. So I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying that it doesn't take much to keep it away from you.
Right.
So, yeah. And the more you get involved with it, the more it becomes part of your system, the more power it can have over you. So, I mean, I remember working with Valentin once, and he was talking about, which I hate to even bring up the words, you know, he was talking about the devil, and I just kind of shut it off, and he said, what is it? I said, Valentin, to even bring that word up, you see, brings it more into reality and gives it more power. So it's best left alone to not even discuss it. And that, for me, is the same idea with brujerismo. I think it's a very low class of power, and just keep it outside. Don't let it out. Don't let it in. So, you know, there's the mind does incredible things. We had a man down 3 conferences ago who was a specialist in remote viewing as well as fork bending. And we had one night at 11 o'clock after the conference was over, we had about 90 to 100 people there with 2 or 3 spoons and forks in their hands. And John taught us how to pull in that energy, whatever you want to call it, whatever it may be, from the sun, from some other dimension, whatever you want to use, to pull it in and bring it up from your feet all the way up through your arm to your fingers as you're holding that fork there, and get that fork hot and make that fork bend. And I saw people holding the fork with one hand and one finger from the other hand on that fork, and then all of a sudden the fork spins around, whips around, bends in full circle, which I couldn't do if I had my other hand completely on the fork to twist it around. And I've got samples of it here. He'll be at the conference next year, not this year, but he'll be back again next year. As well as Graham Hancock will be here in 2011, too. So there's a lot of energies out there and a lot of forces that it's hard to put your finger on as far as, we're not going to be able to identify these things and why they work in a lab, in a microscope, in a test tube. But there's things. There's more than heaven to earth. Yeah, you know?
Yeah. What do you think about the attraction of New Agers into psychedelics, and also how psychedelics have been shrouded in many ways in a lot of New Age, excuse my French, nonsense?
The New Age group, strangely enough, which I didn't expect this, but even the locals here, the gringos that live here, that are not involved in shamanism, that hang out at the Yellow Rose of Texas restaurant and bar and grill where we all kind of meet, have mentioned to me many times that they would have suspected that many of these people coming down here would be very New Age type people, kind of a little bit airy-fairy. And I'm not saying that New Age is not bad, because I'm in many ways New Age myself, but that these people are coming here to drink ayahuasca are lawyers, scientists, doctors, professors, students, and they're people that are very grounded. And I would suspect that someone, if you're speaking stereotypically, a New Age, would be very sort of maybe airy-fairy, that type of person. To have them come into psychedelics, especially come into ceremony with ayahuasca or San Pedro or peyote, would probably give them the grounding that they need. These are serious maestro plants and serious teacher plants. And they will bring you home. They will keep you down. And this is not something you're going to see people doing randomly in Plaza de Armas here. I mean, it tastes terrible, and after about 30, 40 minutes, you're going to throw up, hopefully only once, and then you're going to run to the toilet, and it's not a fun experience. So I think that eliminates a lot of the people that you might be talking about right there.
Let me ask you, Alan, what is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview?
That there are healing modalities out there. We don't just have to be set with what your doctor tells you to take. That's Occidental medicine. There's many other ways. There's folkloric medicine, which is what we're talking about here, is shamanism. And there's more than one way to skin a cat. And a lot of times, the medicines they have in the jungle, they take a little bit more fortitude on your part because they're slower. But they do work, and you need to have a lot of faith in those types of things. And there's always a light at the end of the tunnel, and shamanism is the oldest profession in the world, probably older than prostitution. And so, I just want everyone to know that we're thinking about you, and we'd love to see you down here. And don't brush this off as something that's going to be come and gone like a shooting star. This is growing, and the number of people that are involved is growing too.
All right, Alan, when is your conference, and would you like to give out any website or contact information or anything like that?
Yeah, it's July the 10th to the 17th, the 6th International Amazonian Shamanism Conference. This year it's called Grace and Madness, which is pretty much what all this is about. And the website is www.soga.alma.org. And Soga de Alma means Vine of the Soul. That is the church that I registered here in Peru about 10 years ago, and the sacrament is ayahuasca. So, come on down. And there's information on the website and my email address, and we also get tickets for you. So if you try to book a ticket from the States to fly down here on land Peru, for instance, round trip from Lima to Iquitos, will cost you over $500. But we can book it from here for you for around $250, $260. But there's a lot of information, a lot of frequently asked questions on the website, so please check those out. And if you have any questions at all, don't bother me. I'm just kidding. Ride me. That's what I do all day, is I answer these questions. Apparently, that's what I'm here for.
All right, Alan, thank you so much for your time, and best of luck to you. And I'd like to have you back on and do a little bit longer interview. Maybe we can do that as we're getting close to time for the convention. And,
thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. And we'll talk again soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
No offense, but you are a robot, aren't you?